Kim Sipes is a longtime labor activist and former rank-and-file member of three trade unions. He is currently an assistant professor of sociology at Purdue University, North Central and Westville, Indiana, and member of the National Writers Union. He has been researching and writing on AFL-CIO foreign policy for over 20 years. He is author of KMU, Building Genuine Trade Unionism in the Philippines, 1980 to 1994, has been widely published in the U.S. and around the world. He lives in Chicago and is an old friend. Welcome to Takes on the World, Kim Sipes.
Thank you, Jeff. Glad to be here.
Kim, this weekend the AFL-CIO will be meeting in Chicago at a time when its membership continues to decline, and with it, its impact on the American political, economic, and social scene. There's even the possibility of a major split. Quite apart from that, as if it was operating on a separate planet, the AFL-CIO continues to function as an instrument of U.S. foreign policy, which is the subject of today's program. Before we get into that, however, what in short is the cause of the unrest in the ranks today?
Well, I think the biggest problem is, like you point out, you know, labor's going down. We represent now less than 8% of all private sector workers, only about 1 in 8 workers overall. That's down from 1 in 3 in the early 50s. With that loss means that we're also not near as central to the key industries of the country. It means we're not having as good an effect in electing political leaders we think that will represent the interests of working people. And it's finally dawned on some of the people in the AFL-CIO that we have a crisis. We've got to do something. They've been ignoring that for a long time. So I think the biggest thing that's happening right now is there is an understanding that there's a crisis. We've got to do something. You have two groups that are contending. One group is what's called the Change to Win Coalition, which includes the Service Employees International Union, the food and commercial workers, the Teamsters, let's see, the laborers, and then the carpenters are in one group, and the rest is the Sweeney administration leads the rest. This is not a left-right split as I see it. It's one group that says we've got to have a strategic plan for organizing. The other one is saying, well, things are moving about this, you know, we're basically doing the right thing. We just have to do more of it. And there's a lot of snorting and a lot of smoke. I don't see a lot of fire in the difference between the two, unfortunately.
Yeah, it seems actually that in recent years, or for a number of years, that the AFL-CIO and the major unions have spent more money on trying to elect Democratic Party candidates than they have actually in organizing. Is that a fair perception?
I think so. I mean, you know, when we talk about the American labor movement, though, Jeff, we've got to be careful because it's not the same across. You know, the AFL-CIO is a voluntary federation that includes, I think there's 57 unions that are affiliated. I may be off a little bit, but not by much. And that each union basically does what it wants to do. Some unions, like the SEIU, to its credit, are out there spending a lot of money organizing, pushing for that. Others are not. Others are much more interested in political activities. But I think overall, your statement is correct, that there's been a lot more interest in electoral politics than there is in actual organizing and strengthening the labor movement internally. I think that's a fair statement.
Now, even though the membership in trade unions has declined continuously over the years, quite apart from that, as I mentioned in the introduction, the AFL-CIO has functioned as an instrument of U.S. foreign policy quite removed from the knowledge of the rank-and-file workers without their information. Even, I guess, at one time during the Cold War, they were spending more money on international relations, international affairs, than they were domestically. You've written an article you call Labor Imperialism. Maybe you could run that down for us, how that's worked out.
Okay. Well, first let me say two things. One, you're right. They have been operating in a very imperialist manner around the world, and this has been done behind the backs, not only the rank-and-file members, I think it actually is behind the backs of an awful lot of even high-level members. It's a very, very, very small part of the executive committee that seems to be interested and involved with with foreign affairs. That being said, they are acting in the name of American workers without letting us know, without being transparent, without honesty and things like that. That's true. Let me give a quick overview. I mean, this stuff is not new. In fact, it even precedes the AFL. It goes, the AFL-CIO, it goes back to the days of the Mexican Revolution when Samuel Gompers and the AFL, American Federation of Labor, intervened in the Mexican Revolution to try to undercut more radical anarchist-led type trade unions and things like this. You had the AFL under Gompers very active in supporting World War I and doing all they could to undermine resistance to that. You had them try to control labor throughout Western Europe, and it was the AFL that played a lead role in formulating U.S. foreign policy against the new Soviet Revolution in 1917 and thereafter. So this goes back a long time. Currently, you see after World War II, you see the AFL was involved in helping to overthrow the democratically elected government in Guatemala, the democratically elected government in Brazil, the democratically elected government in Chile in 73, and in addition to that, they were actively involved in attacking progressive governments in Guyana in 1964 and in the Dominican Republic in 1965 and in Nicaragua in the 80s and early 90s. So this list goes on and on. Now, what was interesting is that around Central America, rank-and-file unionists came together and actually were able to stop the AFL from backing what looked like a play for Reagan to invade Nicaragua. We stopped that. And then later in 1995, when Lane Kirkland was removed, or his surrogate, Tom Donahue, was removed from office and John Sweeney came in, part of the reason for that change was disgust at this foreign policy stuff. Sweeney came in, started making good moves, and he took a qualitatively better approach than had been done under George Meany or Lane Kirkland, his predecessors. What he did was instead of having basically independent operations in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, as well as Western Europe, he got rid of these semi-autonomous organizations and collected them under one organization, which was called ACIL, American Center for International Labor Solidarity, and sometimes this gets referred to as the Solidarity Center, but they're one and the same. So he did that. He put a progressive in charge. They actually did something terribly radical and started supporting some worker struggles under the old days of AFIL and AFLI and things like that. They never did. So a radically improved situation. It looked like Sweeney was addressing this. Now, let me say with that, there were still some things that some of us recognized. I mean, for example, I saw that he did not drop the link to the National Endowment for Democracy. Judy Ansel in Kansas City was writing about the amounts of money, the millions of dollars they were getting from the federal government to set up and build offices and support operations around Latin America. And Peter Ratcliffe up in the Twin Cities saw that there was still one of the old Cold Warriors that we thought had gotten rid of. He was put in a less prominent spot, but he was still active and helped undercut a struggle against privatization by Mexican railroad workers in northern Mexico at the end of the 90s. Now, that being said, we individually decided to let Sweeney alone. Let's give him some slack. Let's see what he's going to do. Okay, so what happened is, nonetheless, we worked on efforts to get Sweeney. We said, look, we can no longer stand alone. We've got to unite with workers around the world. We have, the AFL-CIO has this terrible, terrible history, and that the only thing we can do, it's not enough to say, sorry guys, we won't do it again, or anything such as that. We have to come clean about our past record, open the archives, talk about our history, and clear the air. So that was one thing that happened. Sweeney and his people refuse to do that. They have never given us a complete accounting, and I'll come back to that in a minute. The second thing was in April 2002, when the attempted coup against Hugo Chavez took place in Venezuela. I'd just been studying what happened in Chile, and I saw the same patterns again. So I suggested that the AFL was back on track. I didn't have the proof then. I subsequently got the proof. They were involved in actively participating in the buildup to the coup attempt in Venezuela. And then last year, operating off a tip from a guy named Chris Townsend in D.C., Chris works for the United Electrical Workers, I found that Sweeney and his foreign policy people were involved in an initiative with the U.S. government, specifically the State Department, first under Madeleine Albright, but then under George Bush's Colin Powell, and this was called the Advisory Committee on Labor and Diplomacy. So what they were doing is helping the State Department decide how to strengthen its operations around the world, and the State Department's always been one of the key actors in tackling labor around the world. Like I say, it started under Albright. It continued under Bush. So here we have, on one hand, John Sweeney claiming Bush is the Antichrist to workers, and yet what do we find? We find out of six meetings in the Bush period of this advisory committee, John Sweeney was present at every one of the six. He had 100% attendance rate. We see Harry Camberis, the head of the Solidarity Center, again, you know, present 100% of the time. So what I argued in the May 2005 issue of Monthly Review is that the AFL-CIO has returned to its longtime policy of imperialism. How's that for a short answer?
Well, no, that's a good answer. One of the things that we've seen is that this seems to be going on such a vacuum that the rest of the American movement, the American left, seems to be isolated from these struggles that have gone on. I remember struggles within the labor movement during the Cold War at various conventions, but it seems like we move in different planets and different circles, and we haven't been able to coalesce around, let's say, labor activists have not been able to get people from outside of labor to join the struggle to change these policies.
Well, that's true. There's a couple of reasons for that, I think. I mean, part of the reason is that labor is very insular. If you're not part of a union, you really don't have a chance to speak. And truth be told, especially on foreign policy stuff, that doesn't matter anyway. But I think the labor movement has been very exclusive. Now, this goes back to their type of trade unionism. Say, if you look back at the 30s and 40s, when you had the emergence of the CIO, you had, you know, traditionally the AFL unions were very much self-interested. It was a business union type of thing. And you had the rise of the CIO. Now, some of the CIO unions, and not all of them, by the way, but some of them had a broader idea of trade unionism, seeing it as a force for social and economic justice. So not only were they working for higher wages, they were fighting racial discrimination, sexual oppression, whatever, in the factories and making some big, big, big changes. And that was important. But it was this broader vision of trade unionism that got basically wiped out of the labor movement in late 1949 under the communist purges. Now, the reality is the attack was on this broader social justice form of trade unionism than an attack on the Communist Party per se, because, yes, the communists played key roles in certain sites and certain unions, but they weren't everywhere, and they were Trotskyists, they were anarchists, they were militant rank-and-file workers, et cetera, and all of them got wiped out. And since then, we've never had that resurgence of that social justice form of unionism take place. So most activists, seeing that the union movement has largely been a business unionist movement that's refused in a lot of cases even to fight for its own interests, they've sort of scorned the labor movement. And, I mean, there's some of us in there that also have been solidarity activists around different country struggles. You know, I've been in struggles around the Philippines, certainly, in South Africa. A couple that I was in Central America, and I've also been, as a veteran, I've been involved in the vets movement, the progressive vets movement. You know, I've been in the anti-nuclear weapons movement, stuff like this. So I cross those boundaries, but not many people do, and especially not many people who don't have a foot in labor have come into the labor side. So that's one thing. Part of the problem, though, is because people haven't made that jump, is they tend to assume that the labor movement is hopeless, that it should be written off and stuff like that. And I think that's incorrect. I think folks need to know that there's a number of us who are struggling quite hard to change the unions, to rebirth this sense of social justice unionism in this country, to fight the foreign policy issues and stuff like that. They're good people doing stuff. We need the support of the larger solidarity movement. And one of the things that's been really fun to see is that when we as we've been fighting this foreign policy stuff, Z Magazine, for example, I mean, ZNet, their website, Michael Albert has been great in putting a lot of stuff up. And there's others. He's not the only one. Monthly Review has been quite supportive. Things like this. So there are people out there, but we need more. And we're trying to build ties. And we have a demonstration in Chicago that we've called to support this resolution. And we've had a number of solidarity activists, particularly around the Latin American Solidarity Coalition, who've stepped up and are really, really fighting with us on that.
Now, what resolution you're talking about? You're talking about the resolution coming from California Labor Federation.
Right. One of the things that's happened is that over the years, people in California have fought very hard, educated, agitated, raised hell, all kinds of stuff like this around this foreign policy stuff. And since I lived out in the Bay Area, as you know, in much of the 80s, I was involved in this out there. And certainly a key person that's been active in this is a man named Fred Hirsch. Fred is the vice president of the Plumbers Local in San Jose, and he's the man that exposed, way back in 1974, exposed to the AFL role in the coup in Chile. And Fred's hung in there, and he's still doing this great work. Well, like I said earlier, activists were trying to get the Sweeney administration to clear the air, and they refused. So Fred and some people initiated efforts in California in 2002 to get a resolution passed at the California State Fed Convention. An AFL representative basically came down and did what looked like a deal, saying if you water down the resolution, we'll get the foreign policy folks out for a serious talk. Well, it took, and the deal was accepted by the activists ultimately, it took them 15 months to get a meeting together, and rather than coming out and treating people respectfully, they came out and did a dog and pony show, wouldn't answer substantive questions, including the specific request for a country-by-country update on what they're doing today. They refused to give this to the California State Fed. And so a number of resolutions went into the 2004 convention in San Diego, and out of it came this overall resolution called Build Unity and Trust Among Workers Worldwide. And it went to the floor, and it passed unanimously by the California State AFL-CIO. Folks in California, I got to be proud on this. This was a major play. And so that resolution has come to the National AFL-CIO convention here in Chicago. It's not going to take place this weekend, by the way. It's Monday through Thursday of next week, although there are some preliminary things. But anyway, it's come to the resolution. The way this stuff works is it goes to a resolutions committee. The resolution committee sort of picks and chooses whatever it wants to. And so, of course, the composition who's on the resolutions committee is important. And we're kind of afraid that they might try to bottle up this resolution there. The powers that be do not want this resolution to pass. We're trying to work against it. So myself and Fred Hirsch and other labor activists are working with a number of people from the Latin American Solidarity Committee, who's put up a lot of time and energy and even money to support this. And we're holding a demonstration on Sunday afternoon here in Chicago at 4 p.m., trying to support the work of the people inside the convention to pass this resolution. It would be a major step forward.
You know, you mentioned Fred Hirsch. I remember Fred, and he's getting on in years, but he's been one of the great activists on the West Coast. And it occurred to me the first time I saw him was at an AFL-CIO convention in San Francisco, at a meeting of the Defense International Affairs Department of the AFL-CIO, which was actually the first time I had a chance to see, although I didn't know the term at the time, neocons in action, because the first neocons that were active in the American political scene were in the AFL-CIO's International Affairs Department. I remember a guy named Tom Kahn.
Right.
These folks came from the same background as Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, and the rest.
Oh, yeah.
They had very close connections, but folks on the outside never really knew this. Perhaps you could run down some of the past history. Even, you know, you mentioned Chile. That was a significant intervention by the AFL-CIO. Perhaps you could run that down for people.
Okay. Well, basically what happened was, we have to go back a little bit. After World War II, the AFL helped set up a global thing called the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions. And it was a confederation of national labor centers around the world. And they had an operation in Latin America called ORIT. And I don't, O-R-I-T, and I don't speak Spanish, and I'm not going to torture your listeners here in trying to pronounce it. But anyway, ORIT was the operation that they worked through in Guatemala to help overthrow the democratically elected government. However, when Fidel Castro came to power in Cuba in 59, by 1962, labor decided ORRIT was not sufficient for their purposes, that they had to have their own operation to respond more promptly to challenges, should we say. So along with President Kennedy's Alliance for Progress in 1962, the AFL-CIO put up a thing called AFLD, the American Institute of Free Labor Development. And this was headed by both labor and management people, J. Peter Grace of the Grace Company, a major multinational, was on the board of directors. I think Grace was the chair. And they basically did whatever they could around Latin America to undercut any type of progressive unions, any type of unions that wanted to struggle. They would challenge efforts that would even question their own country's relationship to the United States. I mean, it was a terrible operation. It wanted complete subservience to the empire. And so when Chile elected Salvador Allende, the president, which was done under constitutional terms, you know, AFLD got really freaked out. And so they started operating within the Chilean labor movement, trying to split it. And they were unable to do that. The Chileans were really solid. But what they did was they started operating among professional organizations, such as the Maritime Officers Union. They worked with truck owners and eventually caused major truck strikes and things like this. They were very much involved in underpinning the entire Chilean economy. And although Chile has a long coastline, most of the goods transfer by truck in that country. So it was in late 72, if I remember correctly, there was a major trucker strike. Everybody thought it was a truck driver strike, but in reality, it was a truck owner strike. So the AFL-CIO was working with all these things. They even had an organization of dentists in this. I mean, it was an amazing thing. And they sabotaged the economy and laid the groundwork for the coup on September 11th, 1973. So very much involved. There's absolutely no question on this. And they were involved in meetings with the State Department, which included the CIA and stuff like that. No question on this stuff. And detail this in a article that was published in 2000 in Labor Studies Journal, summer 2000, where it lays that out. So very much involved. And that's the kind of stuff they were doing in Venezuela. There was a right-wing trade union federation called the CTV, and that's what the initials are in Spanish, and it's Confederation of Venezuelan Workers in English. And they worked with the CTV leadership and took an active role in bringing them together with the business association, sort of the Chamber of Commerce, if you will, in Venezuela, called Fedecámaras. They also brought in parts of the Catholic Church, and they also brought in some, at least we know of one right-wing governor into this process, one of the states in Venezuela. So they played an active role in bringing these together. Now, on April 11th of 2002, building off a protest against the firing of oil company managers, not workers, the CTV and Fedecámaras led this struggle that basically led this coup attempt. And the head of the CTV was a guy named Carlos Ortega, and his buddy with Fedecámaras, the ultimate leader, was Pedro Carmona. And interestingly, what happened was that when they got Chavez out of the presidential palace and Carmona took over, Carmona stabbed Ortega in the back and did not give any of the labor folks in the coalition any power. And it was only after that that the CTV condemned the coup. In the morning, however, before Carmona did this, Ortega, the CTV leader, was calling for the dissolution of the National Assembly. And that afternoon, Carmona did. He dissolved the National Assembly. He dissolved the Supreme Court. He did all kinds of terrible things. And like I say, he betrayed Ortega, and then Ortega got a little pissed at being stabbed in the back by his butt. But the AFL Solidarity Center in Caracas was very much involved in this process, and this is not speculation. We have the Venezuelan Solidarity Committee in New York City unearthed some documents through a Freedom of Information Act request, and you can see their report to the National Endowment for Democracy, and it's really clear. Now, that brings in another actor.
The National Endowment for Democracy.
Yes. Let me talk a little bit about them. The National Endowment for Democracy is one of the most cynical operations I've ever come across. It was initiated by that great long-term dedicated person, dedicated Democrat, Ronald Reagan, in 1983. And basically what this is, it was set up and it was insulated from any political process. There is no political control over this operation. So for example, if George Bush woke up tomorrow, now I can't say if he got religion, but say he turned over a new leaf tomorrow and wanted to stop that, he couldn't do it. It's completely politically insulated from any type of political control other than their board of directors, of which the National Endowment picks their own board of directors. And their executive director is a man named Carl Gershman, who's a former member of the Social Democrats USA, who you were talking about. Tom Kahn was SDUSA. He's in those neocon circles. This is all admitted. See, what had happened was in the 70s, if you recall, we were able to expose a lot of stuff that the CIA was doing around the world. And Reagan and his folks said, well, this is terrible. And they weren't talking about the things the CIA was doing. It's just that when they got exposed, that made the CIA look bad. So they said, look, let's just do all this stuff publicly. We'll set up this National Endowment for Democracy, and we'll do the same things. You know, and that's what they've been doing. And so they've been operating around the world. Venezuela's the clearest case that we have, but they have operated all around the world in Haiti and stuff like this. And although their claim is to promote democracy worldwide, and if you look at their website, it's just nauseous to read this crap. But where it gets really cynical, which I spoke of, is in their definition of democracy. Now, most Americans have been taught, you know, one person, one vote. If a decision has a chance to affect us, we get to have our say. You know, it goes back to the old no taxation without representation argument. Now, that type of democracy, which we have, is what's called a popular democracy. It's a grassroots democracy, and that's one of the strengths of the country. But what NED and these democracy-promoting programs out of the U.S. government are doing are promoting a top-down and elite model of democracy. So in other words, yes, you get to vote in an election, but the choice is between Pepsi or Coke.
Yeah.
You know, there's no real choice. If you are going to come up with solutions, you're welcome to vote or choose between solutions as long as they're what the elite proposed. So it's a very top-down controlling operation. And what they're doing is they're using the rhetoric of popular, of grassroots democracy, but in reality are advancing a top-down model of democracy. It's a very cynical movement, and it's just gotten its budget doubled by George Bush. Now, you know, when George is talking about democracy, he ain't talking about the same thing you and I are, Jeff.
You're
Trust me on that.